Gentlemen, this is Democracy Manifest.
To my mind, there's only one way to describe those marches. They are hate marches.
Shut the fuck up, you cunt!
I think AI is one of the biggest threats.
I know it's true. It's all because of you. And if I may...
Hello and welcome to Pod Culture Vultures.
In fucking Stratford, you see someone shitting in the fucking phone box. Only in fucking Stratford. Fuck. Yo, it's not a fucking toilet. It's not a toilet, love. Fuck off. Yeah, dirty bitch. Dirty bitch. I'll shit up in that blood clot phone box.
With me, Dino. And joined with me, as always, is my hetero life mate, Kevin Enosh. How's it hanging, mate?
It's all right, so I've got a sweet stuck in my tooth. Lovely sweet tooth.
Brilliant.
Lovely, yeah. Lovely.
I was going to say to you that the other day when I was watching Only Fools, I noticed, you know, in the one when Rodney gets married, he goes on his stag do.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've got a comedian in the...
Yeah. There was this tall fella.
It was a woman.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't quite tall, was he? He was short. He was really short. There was this woman.
That bloke plays the police officer in To Hull and Back. Because he's with... Slater,
yeah,
when they opened the back of Denzel's van.
Is he really?
Yeah, and as
the one that they, he's the one who's got to go open the truck, isn't he? Because he's the one who does the old voice when they're like running around. You go in the back of the pub. He's like,
yeah.
They open up the door to the pub, yeah. And he's just stood there. I didn't know that was him.
Yeah, it's the same guy.
Oh. How about that?
Strange.
Fact. Yeah.
Guy, what have you been watching recently? Anything good?
I started watching that Savile TV show you mentioned before, The Reckoning. I've still got the last episode to watch. But it's not a particularly nice subject at all. But Coogan is just unbelievable. He's absolutely outstanding. If he don't win a BAFTA or some kind of recognition for that alone, I'll be really surprised.
Because, well, I said, didn't I? He deserves a BAFTA for it.
Yeah.
Whether they're giving one or not, based on the fact of the subject matter, but...
Yeah, but then it shouldn't really come down to the subject matter. It should come down to the performance, really. But he's just got it. He's nailed it. He's nailed every aspect of that man's character and mannerisms and everything. He's got the voice down. And even when he's doing the... when he's being interviewed by the author...
Yeah.
Who's compiling a book about him, like an autobiography. When Coogan is just sat there and he's like, oh, like this, and he's got the cigar, and he's got all the jewelry and stuff. It's just, switch off that it's Coogan, it's Savile. He's just absolutely like nailed it.
Now, Mr. Writer Man.
That's it, Writer Man. Yeah, what's the other name he calls him, though?
I can't remember.
He does refer to him as something else, doesn't he? I can't remember what it is, but...
Wordsmith?
It might be Wordsmith,
yeah. Mr. Wordsmith,
yeah. But that was... I've enjoyed that. They've really captured the time frames really well. The only time I see Coogan, as I said before, is when you see the earlier versions of Savile and he's got short, dark hair before he bleaches it.
Yeah.
Then you can clearly see it's Coogan. He doesn't have, like, all of the wig on and stuff. And then every now and again, a bit of Partridge will slip by.
Yeah,
he's making was it in there when he's a DJ in the club at the beginning, and so, I think some geezer trying he gets in for free or something, And it's when you see the real dark side of Savile, because he's, it's brought to his attention. He goes up the back. They're holding the guy in an office, and he and Savile basically tells to this other guy, security guy, to basically do him over.
Beat the shit out of him, yeah.
Yeah, and as he, you can hear him getting the shit beat out of him. There just so happens to be a table outside the room with tea and coffee, and he just casually makes a cup of tea, so it doesn't bother him whatsoever.
Yeah,
that's the really menacing side.
Yeah.
But Partridge comes out when he goes to walk out the door, his cup of tea, and he just goes, twat.
Yeah. Twat. Yeah, I did watch an interview with Steve Coogan, and obviously he said it was something that he was in two minds about doing, because obviously he was concerned with the reception of him doing it, because obviously it wasn't a comedy part, really.
Mm.
But he said it's definitely one that he wouldn't go method on. He said as soon as it's cut, he said, I'm back to Steve Coogan. He said, I cannot. He said, I wasn't able to stay in that character.
He's got a disconnect from it.
Yeah, he said, it was especially with the other actors, which he's had to do some troubling scenes with, straight away was back to being who I was and talking to him normally and not.
Yeah, who's that? Who I'm trying to think. Now you mentioned that, I'm trying to think. There was a film some time ago, and the character you had the villain or the sort of antagonist of the piece.
Yeah.
He was a white male actor, and he was really horrible. His character was really horrible to the protagonist of the piece, who was a black man.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of racism going on between, well, there's a lot of racism given by the white villain.
Yeah.
And it's really bugging me now, because I want to say that the black character was played by Freeman or Washington, but I always remember that in an interview, like the actor who played the villain said, like, he's really got into it, really got into it.
Yeah.
But when it really started getting to the real sort of racial slurs and the use of certain
words,
that he would break down as soon as they cut. He would break down and cry, and he was literally begging for forgiveness. Whereas the other actor said, "You don't need to beg for forgiveness, because you're a character portraying like a nasty piece of shit."
Yeah,
we get that, and it's just, and sometimes actors have to have that disconnect. Some can stay in the character all the time.
Well, that's when you get your method acting, but it's like, I can understand why you wouldn't want to be Savile.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's bugging me now. I can't think of who that other actor was. But because Bale used to be very method early on in his career, and I saw this interview with Jennifer Lawrence once, and they were asking her about, who's been some of the most influential actors you've worked with, and she said, well, Christian Bale was one of them when they did American Hustle, which is just fucking brilliant. And she said at that point, because I felt really intimidated coming into the production, because I'd heard all these things about Bale's method acting and he doesn't switch off. She said, but at that point, he was at a point in his career where he was disconnecting.
Mm.
And she had asked him, she said, how do you get into character? How do you sort of switch off? And he's like, basically, he goes, I don't do the whole method thing anymore. He said, I'm me between takes. And as soon as they say, okay, camera's rolling, he said, literally in 5 seconds or so, he snaps back into character.
Mm.
And she said it was the most mesmerizing thing for her to see. She's seen other actors prepare themselves in different ways, but she's like, here he is, he's just goofing around off set, and then five seconds later he's a completely different character. But I think you're right with the Savile one. It's you'd have to disconnect.
Definitely.
I'm sure you probably enjoyed the whole mannerisms and pretend to be someone differently, because he's always he's done lots of impressions. He's done Savile impressions before.
He's done Savile impressions
on the trip, didn't he?
But he also did it with Savile on a early chat show. There's footage of him, both of them on a programme, and he does him on that. I think that's on YouTube.
Yeah. But But it makes you wonder, like, what was the kind of psychological, what psychological effect it had on Coogan, even when you're disconnecting, because you might be disconnecting, but
you know, yeah,
yeah, you're basically under the skin of a character who destroyed so many lives.
One of the most hated people.
Yeah.
In England now.
Because it starts with his funeral, doesn't it? It starts with the. Starts with the funeral, doesn't it? And you've got all of, like, all of the people there paying their respects.
I remember when it I don't know if I was with you or not, but I was out in the Daniel One-Eyed Dog. Mm. It's because they announced that he'd died, and at the end of the evening, the DJ played the Jim Will Fix It song.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think, yeah, it was the One-Eyed Dog, wasn't it? Yeah.
And then they had all that, and then they had Shane Ritchie do the Jim Will Fix It special at the Christmas,
yeah,
as in tribute. And then, of course, a bit later on, they had the old documentary come out.
I mean,
the guy that had been investigating, and all these people came forward, didn't they?
Yeah. It was just, it astonishes me even to this day how he had pulled the wall over everyone's eyes. I mean, almost like the master illusionist. You know, nobody knew. It was right there in front of us. It might have been on that documentary where they show a clip and he turns up at an office and he's got his, like, running shorts on or something. Like, I can't remember what it is. And he's literally going through this office and he's basically, like, touching up women left, right and centre.
Yeah.
And as it's even in The Reckoning, it's very much like some of the other characters are saying, oh, it's just something that Jimmy did. But yeah. It's like he fooled us so much, so well and so much.
It was accepted for him to do it.
Because of the kind of time and place, maybe. But
like when they also thought that he was such, like, a cuddly type Santa figure. That, just see that, there's that one when that couple let their daughter just go off with him.
Yeah.
And it's fucking hell.
Yeah, that's mad. Well, I'll tell you a reason, another reason it's tainted me a bit is the bit, because when later in the series, when he refers to his mother as the Duchess, yeah, when he moves his mum into her own little flat on, is it supposed to be Scarborough Seaside? Is it Scarborough?
It's somewhere like that, yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's actually, that part is actually shot in Llandudno, which is North Wales. And I know that because that's where we go every year. Right. That's one part of where we go. And I love it. And I remember, like, it's a bit where he goes out to get the chips, doesn't he?
He's going out for a run.
Yeah. And I was like, that's fucking Llandudno. I'm like, that's tainted it now, isn't it? Like, and then, like, the little sort of hotel or place he buys the flat, which is one of the hotels, like, yeah, it's got the little notice board out the front. I'm going to be able to recognise that. That's tainted it now, you know. You know, I've sort of skated along there. I've ran across there. But then it's the, you know, it's good alley sort of trick, you know, the trick of using different locations. But it's fascinating. It's hard to watch.
It is a hard watch. It's not easy to watch at all, but it's... And it's also not something that you'd watch over and over again like Partridge, because it isn't a comedy by any stroke of the imagination. But he's just, his performance is so good. It's done so well. And the actual whole production is so, I would say, respectful to the victims.
Mm.
I just think they did a really good job with it, where it could have been a parody of itself.
Yeah, so I'll finish watching it, and then I'll let you know what I thought of it then. But
now, what shall we talk about?
Beverly Hills Cop. What a movie. Eddie Murphy. 1984.
Nearly 40 years ago. I just can't believe that. I can't believe that Beverly Hills Cop is nearly 40 years old. Eddie Murphy still doesn't look like he's aged a day.
Wow. Give or take.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was... I hadn't seen it in ages, but it is really, it is a really good go-to 80s film.
And it's one of those films where you might not have watched it for a while, but all the dialogue keeps coming back. You know what's about to happen, you know, and you're still excited about it. And it's a great 80s movie.
Mm.
And it just has everything. I know it sounds a bit silly, but everything, it just encapsulates everything about the 80s.
Yeah.
From the soundtrack, with a soundtrack with a very recognisable theme, to the fashion, to even, I mean, the cars, but even to...
He's got a banger, hasn't he?
He's got a banger, yeah, but even to the when they have a point where he's travelling places and they have that little 80s, like, music montage.
Yeah.
You know, there's, like, they have to fill the space with some, like, soundtrack. Yeah. It's just, like, an alteration of the actual main theme.
Well, the other thing as well I noticed as well, they do that when he's actually in Beverly Hills, but when he's going from Detroit to Beverly Hills, they don't fart around with him having to go and get this and that and the other. It's just bang, he's in Beverly Hills. He's managed to get that piece of shit car.
Well, that's what we said then, didn't it? Like, yeah. That car would never make it across, so therefore they've got to just cut it. But like a lot of the of 80s films, they were around that hour and a half, hour and 40 minute mark, and therefore you just didn't fuck about. You did, but yeah, it's a good point, because there are some films, and there would be maybe like 10 minutes of just like getting from A to B, but you know, we know he's in Detroit, we know he's going to Beverly Hills, and therefore you don't need that bit in between, so it just gets the story moving. And also that works well with the fact that in this film, so basically Eddie Murphy is a young cop in Detroit, and his friend comes to visit him. He hasn't seen him in like 6 months or something like that. He's just got out of jail. Basically, he's nicked these bail bonds whilst working at a security guard in Beverly Hills for a big hencho, a big sort of art dealer, crook guy.
Yeah.
And his henchmen basically find him. They knock Eddie Murphy out, but they kill the other guy, and therefore Eddie Murphy wants to take it upon himself to find justice and sort of revenge.
But they fucking execute him, don't they?
Basically, it's brutal. Yeah. So in terms of the whole getting from A to B, he goes on vacation. I know we'll go back to bits and pieces, but he basically volunteers to go on vacation because his captain don't want him around.
But he's got the classic fucking really pissed off black captain.
But obviously he's a bit compromised because it's his friend, and therefore to get things moving and to try and solve the case really quickly, he's got to get from A to B, and therefore the filmmaker Martin Brest just doesn't fuck about. It's just like, well, let's just get him there. But his captain, alongside a lot of the characters, which are, all of them you really like. I mean, even like the villains, they're great. Jonathan Banks from Breaking Bad.
Mike,
yeah. His captain is one of the best, just one of the best standout characters from the movie. He's got brilliant lines. And like you say, he's just really fucking pissed off all the time, shouting and stuff like that. And then you got Paul Reiser, old Burke from Aliens, is like his little buddy cop. This is not my locker.
He's not in it that long, is he? I'll tell you one thing, just going to that actor, what's his name again?
Paul Reiser.
He was in an American comedy sitcom called My Two Dads.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Vaguely.
That was quite a long time ago. It must have been like late 80s, early 90s maybe. But it had him in it, and the other guy was the guy that was in BJ and the Bear. But anyway, the actor. But basically, the premise of the comedy was the woman that had the daughter had died. She didn't know which one of these two the father was, so she went to live with them both. But they were both like chalk and cheese, so it was like the odd couple. And it's just like, what the fuck? When you think about it now, you just think, what the fuck? I mean, it'd just be like My Two Dads. It'd just be like a gay thing now, wouldn't it? I mean, it'd just be like a homosexual, easy. But they went through that whole rigmarole to get around the fact of not having homosexual men in a sitcom to have two odd couple blokes. Fucking hell.
How long did that go on for?
There was a few years it went on for, but they were both the characters, they were both two completely different types of people. So they were the odd couple, so they ended up living together in order to bring up the daughter because they didn't know which one of them was the father.
Yeah, you wouldn't get that these days. You just wouldn't. Even that seems really unlikely why they would all move in together.
It's just bizarre. I don't even think it would have been then, though. I mean, we just accepted it because it was on, it was made. But I just find it bizarre. When you think about stuff I've thought about, I don't know why it popped up in my head the other day, but I just thought, what the fuck was that about? What the fuck was that about? I mean, you've never heard it of it again. It's never been repeated or anything.
No.
And it's just like...
Or remade.
What the fuck? You wouldn't need to remake it. Because they've done Modern Family, haven't they? So...
Well, yeah. That went on for... I mean, that's finished now, isn't it?
I think so. I didn't really watch that.
I watched the first two or three seasons, but then it was just one of those ones that just it just dropped away from me. But
yeah.
I think the last time I heard it, it had gone on for about 10 or 11 seasons. And I just, at the seasons I'd watched, got up to, I just couldn't imagine it going that far. But then Futurama's just been renewed for another two seasons. That must be going for what, 20 plus years?
Oh, no, I thought it was cancelled. They must have been bringing it back.
But I think from what I heard on the news was they had brought it back before and they brought back all of the original cast and then it's been renewed for another two seasons. But
I know they did a load of sort of feature length Futurama things.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, so the Beverly Hills Cop.
Sorry, we digress.
We digress, yeah.
Back to Axel Foley. Axel Foley!
But yeah, he's got these really good interactions with his captain. And that's that bit at the beginning, isn't it? Like, he comes busting into the locker room. Where the fuck is Foley? And literally every other word is fuck coming from the captain. And he sort of says... he's like, your antics are just costing me too much. You know, it's like, what is he? Like, the mayor's called the chief of police. The chief of police is called, like, the commissioner. The commissioner's called me and chewed my ass off. And, you know, he's really fucking grilling Foley. And as he goes to walk away, Foley can't help himself. He's like, he's like, Captain, you know, you've still got a bit of that ass left. Don't fuck with me, Foley.
Don't with me, Foley.
What I would say is, I mean, in this film, so this is probably, what's this, like Eddie Murphy's, like, I don't know, maybe like third film or so. He's young. I think he's only about 21 in this film. You would never think he was 21, especially if you look at a lot of 21-year-old actors in films similar or taking on a big lead role like that at such an early age. He is so fucking good in it. And it's not even just like the comedic aspect, because he and... what's his name? Taggart and Reinfeld, Judge Reinfeld, all ad-libbed a lot of their lines. It's not just the comedic bit, it's all of the action and it's all of the dramatic bits. It really, I feel like this film really established Eddie Murphy as a very well-rounded actor and just really good.
He's good. I still can't believe when you said earlier, he was 19 when they did 48 Hours.
I'm sure he was like... 1920, or maybe he was about 21, 23 for...
That's another classic video cover that was always in the video shop. 48 Hours, with the, because he had a really... On that drawing, he's got a really long middle finger.
for a perspective. Isn't it?
Yeah. But it doesn't quite work.
No.
We should do that as well.
We'll do that, yeah.
Nick Nolte.
It's another buddy cop, isn't it? So, and like with Beverly Hills Cop, it's like buddy cops, isn't it, plural? But it's good. The contrast is really great where he's come from. Like when Beverly Hills Cop starts off, even the opening scenes, it really gives an idea of what Detroit looked like in that year in terms of like, you know, sort of, you know, in terms of like the landscape, the economy.
The thing is, Detroit's at that time was always seen as being the most crime-filled city in America,
very
wasn't
run
it?
Down, yeah.
Yeah, and that's why RoboCop set there.
Yeah, yeah. and then the contrast being
Detroit City, baby.
What the fuck?
I don't know why I did that.
And then Beverly Hills, Beverly Hills just being the absolute like Beverly other end of the spectrum. Yeah.
Beverly Hills cock. Beverly's cock.
Oh, I bet there's one. I bet they both exist actually.
Beverly Hills cock.
Oh, no, I love it because it's just
bird called Beverly is hermaphrodite.
I bet it exists. I bet it exists. You look it up in a minute.
Chicks with dicks are mad shame.
I saw a guy with a Berserker t-shirt on the other day.
Did you?
Because it's actually the character there. Yeah. Holding it like the...
My love for you is making fuck Berserker!
Kicking cock Berserker!
Yo, Olaf.
Hey, Olaf. Metal. Brilliant. But yeah. So Beverly was caught. But I think it's got everything. I mean, it's got action, it's got drama, it's got loads of comedy, but when you get the, and it's gritty at times. You see the execution at the beginning.
That is grim.
And some of the other bits in there, like the fights and stuff, are really gritty. And it's also one of those films where, you know, we watched it a lot when we were growing up. And when growing up, you know, when they have it on the TV, they would cut a lot of the swearing or cut a lot of the more violent scenes. And therefore, you watch it back now and you think, oh, shit, there's loads. Yeah. There's so much more swearing in it than you think. Literally, like every other line in some scenes.
Fuck, yeah.
It is fuck, yeah.
There's the scene when he gets thrown out the window, which is near the beginning, which is good. But it's just, again, bizarre how they walk him all the way to the front door.
Well, they carry him all the
they
way
carry, down. Yeah, there. And then rather than just opening the door, they fucking swing him out the fuck.
Yeah. Because the old geezer who's disturbing in charge doesn't look, seem to be the kind of guy they want to cross, and yet they've just gone and cost him like probably a couple of grand.
Definitely on a window.
On the window, yeah. But then there's that really funny line he says, doesn't he? Because he gets tossed out the window and he's just sitting there and he's like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And then these cops turn up and they're all really nice and they're respectful, aren't they? Like, sir, can you get up, sir? You're under arrest, sir. And then he says, what am I getting charged with? And they said, you're getting charged with possession of a firearm and disturbing the peace. He's like, disturbing the peace? I got thrown out of a fucking window. He's like, yeah. What do I get charged for if I get thrown out of a car? Jaywalking. it's fucking sharp. It's like really good.
Yeah.
And the jokes are, they are just really cool. And there's just so many funny little scenarios that he gets himself into. Like when he goes to Beverly Hills police station, and then they find out he's a detective police officer, and then you start to establish the characters and their relationships. And basically Taggart and what's Judge Reynolds' character again?
I can't remember what his actual name is.
Rosewood.
Yeah.
Rosewood. They are basically they're told by their chief officer, who's Roddy Cox from RoboCop, Bogeyman, isn't it? Bogeyman. That they have to tail him. They have to watch Foley's every move because Roddy Cox has spoken to his Detroit captain. His Detroit captain said he cannot be out. Foley cannot be out there investigating the murder of his best friend. If he does, he doesn't need to come off. He's come home. He's done. He's done as a he's a copper. He's on his last legs as being a copper anyway. So they follow him and they tail him. And it's just like the funny antics where he's checked himself into the Beverly Hills Hotel. He's blagged his way in saying he's a journalist for the Rolling Stone. Yeah. And to stitch these two coppers up, he's got the hotel to send out like a load of like late supper food. And then he's gone and got these bananas from Damon Wayans. Actually, his character.
That's an early gig for him, isn't it?
That was very early, yeah. For playing Banana Man in the credits.
And he's very camp, isn't he?
Mm. You can pick a banana. Yeah. And he just sticks the bananas up the tailpipe.
Damon Wayne's arm.
Yeah.
Banana Man.
Yeah. Ooh. So they try to chase Foley, and the car conks out, and it's so funny, and it's just so stupid. And
yeah, but it's good.
But it's definitely, I mean, it's an Eddie Murphy show, but...
Doesn't he do that in one of the other films? He does it again to him in the second one. Puts the bananas in.
I can't remember, because I mean, there's...
I'm sure he does.
Because they've done three of them, haven't they? But they're supposed to be making the fourth one now.
Well, I thought they'd made it and it was going to come out. Because they got the teaser posters for it, didn't they?
What, for the fourth one?
Yeah.
Have they?
I'm sure they have. Let me have a quick look while you're
Because I remember at one
vamping.
At one point they were going to make a TV show, and they made the pilot, and it was supposed to be, the main character was supposed to be Axel Foley's son.
Okay, played by,
I don't know who's going to play him, but
say what?
But the story goes, from what I had read, that Eddie Murphy made a cameo in it, and at this point they didn't really think, you know, Eddie Murphy had it anymore. Yet he sort of turned up, switched it on.
Yeah.
And then they basically were so impressed that he still had it that they then abandoned the TV show, and they've been trying to get this fourth one.
Yeah.
Going. But yeah, it's got a great soundtrack, such a recognisable soundtrack. So I remember, like, in school there was a kid who was good on the old piano,
yeah,
and played the main theme tune for assembly once. But yeah, all of the characters are really good. Like, say, Ronnie Cox, I mean, the two other coppers, even the other team who take over from Taggart and Rosewood. You know, what team are you? You're the second team. Like, yeah, we're the first team.
Yeah, and then he does this little white man's voice at the black guy.
I said, yeah.
It's
there at the belt.
It's in post production.
What was it?
And it's released on Netflix next year.
Oh, okay.
Because I know that Netflix have spent a lot of money getting Eddie Murphy.
Oh no, that's right. Yeah, because they had done it, because there was, I saw pictures where he was wearing the old Detroit jacket.
Yeah.
That he has in the second one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that'll be interesting. Yeah. I mean, it's like they're all.
Because I still thought he was going to do another stand up for Netflix, because they're quite big on doing that, aren't they?
Well, I thought he signed a deal, didn't he? I thought he had signed a deal to do.
Well, he's done a couple of films for them, hasn't he?
Yeah, but for one of the press for his films, it might have been like My Name Is Dolomite. I'm sure on the press for that, they'd asked him, would you ever return to stand up? And he said, yeah, I've signed a deal with Netflix. And,
yeah.
But that was probably going back a number of years ago. So I don't know if he's still, maybe he's writing it and.
Yeah.
Still writing it, I don't know.
The thing is, it's like Ricky Gervais, his stand up, he sold, didn't he, to Netflix for $38 million.
Yeah.
Very good money if you can get it. But yeah, it culminates in basically the guy that's an art dealer, it turns out, as usual in the '80s, it's a front for getting coke over.
Yeah, he's a proper wrong, isn't he?
Yeah. Covers it in coffee. To disguise the sniffers.
Yeah, and there's a couple of really good scenes in it where Foley actually demonstrates how good of a cop he is. Because in the Beverly Hills department, in their eyes, he's pretty much some young
maverick.
Maverick from Detroit. There's a couple of times, one being that when they're all in the police department, and for the first time, Ronnie Cox starts to pay attention to what Foley's trying to achieve. And he says, you know, I've gone to the warehouse and they've got these shipping these boxes, and there's loads of coffee in it. And the rest of the group are like, yeah, well, so what? And Ronnie Cox is like, well, no, to smuggle cocaine,
you would. They often pack it in coffee to hide the smell.
Yeah, and that was, you know, then that's one recognition of how good of a cop Foley is. The other one is the scene when they go to the strip club, and the two guys come in with the big old leather jackets, and Foley is just like dancing around, like just being a bit silly, isn't he?
Yeah.
And then suddenly he just switches. You know, he's the only guy who's recognised. These two fellas have come in wearing long trench coats in summer. Something's off. Something's about to go down. And suddenly his whole persona changes, and he says to Taggart, you know, basically, something's going to kick off. I'm going to go take this one. You take that one. This time it's serious. And then they defuse the whole situation because these guys are about to rob the place or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that's where there's some really interesting dynamics between the characters in those sort of scenes where they do recognise that he is more than just like a young maverick, yeah, someone who's just taking the piss all the time.
Yeah.
You know, he is a good cop. He is what the captain
some
says
young
at the beginning.
Punk.
Yeah, like his captain says at the beginning, you know, you're an outstanding young police officer. But basically,
you're a jackass.
Jackass! And yeah, you know, he sort of takes it upon himself to then try and figure out who did it, you know, and it's this art dealer guy and why, and to unravel this kind of mystery and get close this case and then also do well by his friend.
Yeah.
And he's got some funny scenes when he goes to the art gallery, isn't he? Do you remember he goes to the art gallery? Who's the character he meets?
I can't remember what that guy's name is, but he was in
True
Romance.
Yeah, Serge.
Yeah. But he kind of mimics every time he goes up in his volume.
Yeah, how much did this cost? $130,000. Get the fuck out of here! Would you like an espresso with a lemon twist?
No.
Could you tell so and so that Mr. Ahmed Foley is is down here to see him? No, Axel. Aqua. Mr. Foley. But yeah, get the fuck out of here. No, I won't. But yeah.
Good film.
It is great. I mean, I really like the second one as well. Which is very different because it's Tony Scott directing it. So it's very much that that golden hour, isn't it? Like most of it's shot at like towards the end, the sunset kind of time of day. Even the police precinct is so different. In the first one, it's supposed to represent technology, future, cleanliness, professionalism, you know, it's all open and they've got all these computer consoles and all this lot. When you see it in the second one, it looks very much like his brother's like Blade Runner movies. It's very sort of noir.
Yeah.
The police precinct is now suddenly really closed in. It's almost like a claustrophobic kind of element to it. You've got like sun rays or like, you know, that sort of sunset like poking through the blinds. There's like a mist because people are still smoking.
Yeah.
And it's more of an action film.
Yeah, definitely. I haven't watched that in ages either, actually.
You've got Bridget Nielsen, isn't it? She's one of the main villains, yeah. He goes to the gun range, don't he? But, the first two I really do like. I really do like those films. They always make me smile, and I think they're just great action comedy movies. The third one I just thought was just terrible. I mean, by the time he's fucking around with a gun, can roast a chicken. Do you remember that? There's that bit where he's got
not seen it. I didn't even bother.
Oh, you're doing yourself a justice, mate. It was absolutely terrible. Because I'm sure it was going to be something else, and then for whatever reason, it was going to be set somewhere else, and then they set it at a theme park, and it just became, I think it's one of those Hollywood stories where it was meant to be a different film.
Yeah.
But this you know, part of that script then found its way as being Beverly Hills Cop, like when
there's too much input.
Well, it's like with Under Siege, what we're going to do, I'm sure Under Siege originally was meant to be something like Die Hard 3.
Oh, right.
Because it is Die Hard on a ship.
Yeah.
But it didn't for any reason. Then they made Under Siege out of it. And I think Beverly Hills Cop 3 was that. I should have done my research really before this. But it was... Oh, mate, it was just crap. It was just really bad.
I've never got... I think because everyone has said it was so shite, I didn't even bother.
Yeah, and it's
tarnish.
Also, it was whereas the other two were 18s, if I remember right. This one was a 12 or a 15.
I'm sure it was a 12 because of getting more people in to see it.
It was definitely toned down.
Mm.
The first one was what, 84. The second one was what, about 87?
Was it the golden year?
I think it was the golden year. Beverly Hills Cop 3 was, I don't know, 94. Even that's like 30 years ago.
Mm.
That was directed by John Landis. I completely forgot about that.
What, the third one?
The third one was, yeah.
He'd fucking lost it by then.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because it just didn't, definitely didn't have the spark of the first two. Mm-hmm. And I find these films are very much... They remind me of films like the Aliens movie, whereas the first two are so sort of different from each other with two different distinctive visions from two different distinctive directors.
Yeah.
But yet, you know, both of them work really well in their own right, and the second one does really just sort of up the ante. But yeah, no, I can't remember what Beverly Hills Cop 3 was originally meant to be. but yeah, it was definitely something else. But yeah, I wouldn't watch it, mate. Don't let curiosity get the better of you or anyone else who hasn't seen it. Just stick to the first two.
Yeah, 1987, Beverly Hills Cop 2, the golden year.
The golden year.
Anyway, that's Beverly Hills Cop 1.
Mm-hmm.
Great film, great laugh.
Great times.
Great times. Watch it.
Like Chris Akabusi said, get out there, get the fucking job done, or fuck off!
I want you to tell all your friends about me.
Where can they find us, Kev?
Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and now Threads. Any emails or recommendations, pop us over an electronic mail to podculturevultures@gmail.com.
Beautiful. And please remember to subscribe, follow, and rate, and all the other business that goes with your social media claptrap. But until next time, catch you on a flippity-flop.
Gully bye.
That it? Did you do anything else?
No, there's no more.
Right then, well, fuck off. Beverly Hills, that's where I want to be. Living in Beverly Hills, Beverly Hills. Rolling like a celebrity. Living in Beverly Hills.
This is great banter. It really is.